Well, when the subject is torture, whether it's discussion of policy by pundits and officials or a dramatic presentation such as Fox TV's 24, sooner or later it seems the issue of the ticking time bomb comes up. Torture proponents are fond of invoking a scenario where good guys are holding bad guys who they know have information that can stop a catastrophe, and that information can only be gotten by torture. Fox's show 24 is based on the ticking time bomb premise. Well, such vignettes pull together a lot of assumptions about torture, starting with the unlikely scenario of a ticking time bomb. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, your words are exactly right. Scenario and assumptions. First of all, this has never happened. This is one of those rare triumphs of academic philosophy in the field of public policy. 30 years ago, a philosopher named Michael Walzer published an article dealing with the old philosophical conundrum of the dirty hands in an obscure academic journal called Philosophy and Public Policy. And he talked in the abstract about a politician who's faced with a bomb that's going to go off in 24 hours, and what does he do? And Walzer made the argument, hypothetically, that the ethically correct thing for the politician to do would be to, mind you, being fully aware of the moral choice, to order torture. His academic acolyte, Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, picked up that idea, and both here and in Israel, he trumpeted that idea and made it quite popular. And so when 9/11 happened, Dershowitz started appearing on 60 Minutes, writing in the LA Times. He was an omnipresence across the country, arguing for the need to torture based upon the ticking time bomb scenario. It is a philosophical exercise. It's never happened. And when you actually examine it closely, which very few people do, it doesn't really work. First of all, let's look at it carefully. Okay, the terrorist has set the timer on a time bomb, and between the setting of the timer and the bomb's burst, he, by some accident, gets picked up by some police or intelligence, okay? And they know everything about him. They know that among 14 million people in New York, he's the one. They know that he set the bomb. They know the bomb's in Times Square. They know that it's going to go off. They know everything except this one little tiny little bit of information they have to get from him through torture. All of that is a whole series of linked assumptions. And then comes the greatest assumption of all. If you've got one shot at this guy, the assumption is the most effective way to get the information out of him is to torture. And that's a complete assumption, and that's not borne out by the facts. Facts that we know from experienced interrogators who tell us torture, coercion, doesn't work.
Well, that brings me to the second question, which I think you've just started to answer, and that is another myth that pervades recent discussions of torture is that it is effective in securing reliable information. As you mentioned, syndicated columnist Alan Dershowitz, but also Newsweek's columnist Jonathan Alter, each pointed to a 1995 story wherein torture was supposedly effective in revealing a plot to blow up several airliners in midair. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Sure. What happened was this. The Pope was visiting Manila. Philippine police were doing a standard security sweep in downtown Manila. They picked up an Arab visitor, Abdul Hakim Murad, and they found some bomb-making equipment in an apartment in downtown Manila. They supposedly tortured him for 6 months, extracted information that supposedly stopped the so-called Bojinka plot of setting bombs on a dozen trans-Pacific airliners and killing 4,000 people. The only trouble with that entire scenario, which, as you said, Dershowitz and Alter and other torture advocates have put forward, the only trouble with it is it didn't happen that way. Philippine police got everything they needed to know about the bomb plot in the first 60 seconds of the raid. They got his laptop with the bomb plot on the laptop. The torture was all done gratuitously, basically to make him say what they wanted him to say when he appeared on a witness stand in New York. It was all incidental. It didn't produce anything. The question is, what kind of information does torture produce? Well, we actually have a very public incident. At the start of the war on terror, the United States captured the man who was running an Al-Qaeda training camp inside Afghanistan. He was turned over to the CIA, rendered to Egypt, and he was tortured by Egyptians and by CIA, we believe, brutally, savagely, and he started talking about how Saddam Hussein's government had trained al-Qaeda in weapons of mass destruction. That information was typed up, stamped with the rubric of top secret, placed on the desk of Colin Powell, and he stood up in front of the United Nations in February 2003 and said that he had verified intelligence that Saddam Hussein's government had trained al-Qaeda in weapons of mass destruction. Well, that man, Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, was a fabricator. He said that because it stopped the torture. A year later, the CIA withdrew all information from Libby and branded him a fabricator. Former Secretary of State Powell is now deeply embarrassed by that incident. The Senate Intelligence Committee has reviewed it and concluded irrefutably that Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi was tortured into lying.
Well, the abuses at Abu Ghraib were presented to the U.S. public as horrifying but exceptional. But from the very subtitle of your book, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, you're saying that the U.S., particularly the CIA, has employed torture in the past in specific situations.
In April 2004, when the Abu Ghraib photographs were broadcast by CBS television, most people looked at that most iconic of all those photographs of the Iraqi standing on the box, hooded, his arms extended, and fake electrical wires hanging from his arms. Most people looked at that and said, "Oof, creeps, what's this?" William Sapphire said, "Creeps." I looked at that photograph, and I saw the two telltale signs of CIA interrogation techniques, CIA psychological torture. He was hooded for sensory disorientation. His arms were extended for self-inflicted pain. Since then, I've actually been able to go through the Army Criminal Investigation Command of about 1,600 photos taken inside Abu Ghraib prison, and photograph after photograph. There are three things, okay? They're short shackling, long shackling, arms extended for self-inflicted pain. They're hooded for sensory disorientation, and then there's that third and most recent innovation, the veritable perfection of the CIA's paradigm from Guantanamo, and that's the attack on Arab cultural identity through sexuality, gender, and fear of dogs. And you can see that third dimension in those photographs as well. So hundreds of photographs, very consistent, all right? Just three techniques over and over ad nauseum, not random, bizarre, erratic techniques that you expect from sort of seven twisted minds. No, very consistent. And reaching right back for over 50 years right into the CIA manuals on interrogation from the Cold War.
Well, recently in The New Yorker, Jane Mayer reported that a group of military interrogators and human rights representatives, led by U.S. Army Brigadier General Patrick Finnegan, met with the producers of the Fox show 24 to get them to rethink the show's portrayals of torture because, quote, the show promoted unethical and illegal behavior and had adversely affected the training and performance of real American soldiers, close quote. In your book, you suggest that journalism can have a positive role to play, that in fact media have sometimes been more helpful than Congress in spurring investigations.
Sure. One thing that media has done is it's given a voice to retired FBI counterintelligence officials who will tell you that the tough stuff doesn't work. There are two American interrogation doctrines. One is coercive interrogation, torture, developed by the CIA, propagated for the past 50 years. The other doctrine is one discovered by the U.S. Marine Corps in World War II that I call empathetic interrogation. A man named Major Moran found that by interviewing Japanese captives in the Pacific, speaking to them in their language, Japanese, establishing a human bond, he could get complete order of battle intelligence from them in 24 hours. In 24 hours, the most difficult kind of intelligence to get. The FBI employed those tactics in the decades since World War II when they ran our counterintelligence function. And this doctrine of empathetic interrogation works. For example, in 1998, in the East Africa bombings by al-Qaeda, the FBI did their job. They picked up the guys, they established bonds, they confessed, they gave some of our most reliable intelligence on al-Qaeda. Furthermore, they were put into federal courts, they were tried, convicted, and they're now in federal penitentiary. Empathetic interrogation works. Coercive interrogation, i.e. torture, doesn't work. The historical record is very clear on that point.